the northwest African country of Chad is facing a war crimes trial, 22 years after he lost power. The court is being established in the neighbouring country of Senegal, where former Chadian president Hissène Habré has been living in exile. Rights groups are calling on the Senegalese government to act swiftly in trying the former leader. Senegal and the African Union last week signed an agreement to create a special tribunal to try Mr. Habré. A 1992 Truth Commission report in Chad said that during his time in power, he presided over up to 40,000 political murders and widespread torture. A spokesman of the Dakar-based African Assembly for the Defence of Human Rights, Alion Teen, has told Sentila Chingaipe the people of Chad are a step closer to getting justice.
I think that there is a long time Senegalese government wanted to try Hissène Habré. That is 12 years ago. And I think that there was no volunteer from the head of state, President Abdoulaye Wade, to try him. I think now there is a will of Senegalese government. This will is illustrated by the agreement between Senegalese government and African Union. And I think that it's a very good step to combat impunity in Senegal and to see Hissène Habré tried. It's a very good information for all the victims of Hissène Habré, and there is a hope. What we want now is to begin the trial very quickly, is to put and to build this mechanism very quickly, because there is a long time victims are waiting for Hissène Habré trial.
What is he accused of?
You know, he is accused of a crime against humanity, barbaric acts, and torture. I think there is a very serious violation of human rights. And I think that there is a lot of victims that are concerned by the trial. And I think it's a very good thing if now Senegalese government is willing to try Hissène Habré.
Did these incidents happen when he was in power in Chad?
Yes, it happened between the early 80s and the 90s, because on December 19 he lost the power. He flew to come here in Senegal, and the Senegalese government hosted him. Now I think that time is up to try him, because many of the victims died, and now I think there is hope to see Hissène Habré tried, and to see a willing from the Senegalese government to combat seriously impunity, because it's a very important, it's a serious challenge. Because 50 years after the independence of African countries, they have no capacity to try the political elites and the military elites in Africa. And I think that time is up to have the judiciary capacity to try the African presidents or the military that are accused of crime against humanity and very international, international crimes.
Is he going to be tried in a special court being created by the Senegalese government and the African Union?
Yes, it is a special court. It is an African special room who will try Hissène Habré, and with Senegalese and African magistrates. I think it is very important. It will be African mechanism, not a Senegalese mechanism. African mechanism built in agreement between the Senegalese government and the African Union.
Alion Tien from the African Assembly for the Defence of Human Rights, speaking to Santila Chinkayipe. Tributes are pouring in from around the world following the death of the first person to walk on the moon. Neil Armstrong died over the weekend from complications from heart surgery at the age of 82. As commander of the Apollo 11 mission, Mr. Armstrong made history on July the 20th, 1969, when millions across the world watched on their televisions as he stepped onto the moon. Praising Mr. Armstrong as a reluctant American hero, a statement from his family says he served his nation proudly. Naomi Selvaratnam reports.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Spoken as he took his first lunar steps, Neil Armstrong's words immortalized in history one of mankind's most remarkable engineering achievements, the first human to walk on the moon. Today, millions of people around the world will remember where they were the moment they heard the first man had stepped on the moon as tributes pour in for the American astronaut. Mr. Armstrong passed away in the United States following complications resulting from surgery earlier this month to clear blockages from his arteries. In a statement, Mr. Armstrong's family said they were heartbroken by his passing.
Neil was our loving husband, father, grandfather, brother, and friend. Neil Armstrong was also a reluctant American hero who always believed he was just doing his job. He served his nation proudly as a Navy fighter pilot, test pilot, and astronaut. While we mourn the loss of a very good man, we also celebrate his remarkable life and hope that it serves as an example to young people around the world to work hard and make their dreams come true, to be willing to explore and push the limits, and to selflessly serve a cause greater than themselves.
Born in Ohio on August 5th, 1930, Neil Armstrong had an early fascination with aircraft and worked at a nearby airport when he was a teenager. After serving as a naval aviator from 1949 to 1952, Armstrong joined NASA's predecessor agency, the National Advisory Committee for Aeronautics, in 1955, where he gained astronaut status in 1962. Following his momentous mission to the moon in 1969, Mr. Armstrong rarely made public appearances, instead taking on a more low-key appointment as a professor of aerospace engineering at the University of Cincinnati. However, speaking at the 30th anniversary celebrations of the moon landing in 1999, he said the impact of the event was greater than just a scientific achievement.
The important achievement of Apollo was a demonstration that humanity is not forever chained to this planet, and our visions go rather further than that, and our opportunities are unlimited.
Tributes for Mr. Armstrong have flowed since the news of his death broke. Buzz Aldrin, who accompanied Mr. Armstrong on the historic trip to the moon in 1969, told the BBC the space community will miss his presence.
I was fortunate enough to be one of those crew members and to fly with an outstanding test pilot, Neil Armstrong, and accompany him. So it's very sad indeed, and I think the entire space, aerospace world will be very saddened to hear this news. We're missing a great spokesman and leader in the space program.
In a statement, U.S. President Barack Obama described Mr. Armstrong as one of the greatest American heroes of all time.
Naomi Selvaratnam with that report.
The groundbreaking series that sparked a national debate, Go Back to Where You Came From, returns in 2012. Six prominent Australians take the challenging journey to experience life as a refugee. Watch SBS One over three consecutive nights at 8:30 p.m. from Tuesday, August 28. Then join Jenny Brockie for a Go Back Insight special on August 31 and have your say on the series in your language with SBS Radio at sbs.com.au/goback.
The United States presidential campaign is about to kick into high gear. Later today, the traditional Republican National Convention will put the November 6 election front and centre in the American conscience. But what's at play? Ron Sutton reports.
It's a presidential race that conventional wisdom suggests the Republicans and Mitt Romney should win easily. Not only is unemployment in the United States still at more than 8%, but it's also rising in 44 of the 50 states just last month. And little more than 2 months away from national elections, the latest opinion polls show 3 in 5 people in the country feel the U.S. economy's getting worse. Yet as the Republican National Convention approaches, U.S. politics expert Greg Barton of Monash University suggests it's just not working out the way it's supposed to.
The incumbent should be in real trouble given the financial figures and the conventional wisdom. He really should be in a position where he would struggle to be re-elected. And yet, at the moment, it appears to be a close race, and that's because the president is regarded as a more likable, a more approachable guy, somebody you can connect with more than Romney. I mean, the president has his own problems in terms of being seen to be very intellectual and a little bit aloof, but compared with Romney, he's Mr. Charisma.
That is one image Mitt Romney will try to dispel as the Republican convention unfolds over 4 days, starting on Monday in Tampa, Florida. The Democrats will follow with their convention a week later in Charlotte, North Carolina. By then, the Republicans hope to have gained a boost in the opinion polls that currently show President Barack Obama maintaining a slim lead in his bid for re-election. Dr. David Smith at the University of Sydney's United States Studies Center says while the conventions aren't as important as they once were, they still can be pivotal.
Something like 22% of Americans watch at least some of the conventions at some point. And so for most people, this is the first time they really start paying attention to what's going on. And so in a sense, the campaign actually does get serious from the conventions onward. I mean, more people watch at least some of the conventions than watch the Olympic opening ceremony, or at least that's what happened 4 years ago. So even though it's not like it was, say, in the 1960s, where you actually had upwards of 60% of the population watching it, it's still a major event.
The Republicans are expected to roll out their big names for the cameras, from billionaire and short-lived candidate Donald Trump to 2016 hopeful Chris Christie. At least 2 leading female politicians will join Mr. Romney's wife Anne as speakers as the Republicans try to cut into Mr. Obama's advantage among female voters. But Dr. John Hart, a specialist in U.S. elections from the Australian National University, suggests Mr. Romney has bigger obstacles to overcome than just the women's vote. He foresees the former Massachusetts governor trying foremost to seal his standing with the party's conservative wing at the convention. Typically, over the years, the Republican candidates use the convention to try to win back the center politically, after moving to the right to win the vote within the party. But Dr. Hart says Mr. Romney's selection of Paul Ryan as his vice presidential running mate shows he's still pursuing conservative backing as the convention beckons.
That's the way I would interpret it, that he's given up on moving back to the center. And indeed, I mean, some of the positions that Mitt Romney took in order to get the Republican nomination by moving quite a way to the right and trying to win over the Tea Party element of the Republican Party, it makes it very, very hard for him to come back to the center. He really is in a difficult position on a lot of issues.
John Hart compares Mitt Romney's move with Republican candidate John McCain's decision in the 2008 election to take Sarah Palin as his vice presidential choice. Senator McCain, like Mr. Romney, felt the need to strengthen his conservative support at the convention just to get the Republican vote out on Election Day.
He may well have succeeded in reinvigorating the conservative base with Sarah Palin, but the cost of that was losing the independents. And I think Romney's in the same position. He's made the decision. I think the choice of Ryan is very clear and very strategic, and I also think very ill-advised from his point of view. But he's made it. I think the only way he can go is by presenting the image of a very conservative party.
But how to do that effectively? David Smith from the U.S. Studies Center says the Republicans' focus on the ailing economy has let the Democrats in turn articulate who the Republicans are. He predicts the Republicans will use the convention to try to define their party in their own terms, such as the party of small business. But Dr. Smith suggests Mr. Romney has little room for showing himself as any different from what the public already sees.
I don't know how much Romney can actually do at this point, because he is what he is. He has been running on his previous record as a successful businessman, which the Democrats have tried to paint as a vulture capitalist. So I don't know what Romney can actually do to get away from that. I mean, he can't compete with Obama on charisma or personality or anything like that. He needs to be able to present himself as this really sound economic manager. And what he did by adding Paul Ryan to the ticket was just to try to deepen this image of competence, I suppose. And I think that that's all he really can do at this point.
It's not a rosy picture for an election that, on past logic, is supposed to be so easy for the Republicans. Professor Barton, a political scientist at Monash, says adding Paul Ryan could make up the difference, but could just as easily have the opposite effect.
I think there's a real chance that Paul Ryan will be seen to actually make up for some of the deficit of Romney, some of the charisma deficit. He's seen as a very credible fiscal conservative, a real intellectual. That may really be a boost to Romney. Of course, there's also the flip side that Paul Ryan depicted in ads as pushing Granny off the cliff, of being tough on Medicare. That may turn swing voters away.
And Professor Barton reminds, even if the pair's performance at the convention does provide a quick boost in the polls, the Democratic convention's just a week away.
That story by Ron Sutton on SBS National Radio. This is World News Australia with Claire Atkinson. It's 6:30. Caring for ageing Australians is becoming increasingly important as that sector of the populace grows. And caring for those who've experienced trauma in their lives is becoming a particular challenge. Research shows as trauma survivors age, they can often experience a resurgence of painful memories. Jeanette Francis reports on how different communities in Australia are managing that challenge.
There was a knock on our door about 11:30 at night. My father went to answer the door, and there were three of those Slovak SS men with the summons for my two sisters and myself.
This is how Lottie Weiss's story of survival began. She would spend the next 3 years at Auschwitz.
When we were digging in the roads, we could smell burning bodies. And we looked up, you saw only smoke, and nothing but smoke and the smell of burning bodies.
Lottie Weiss was the only one of her family of eight to survive the Nazi concentration camp at Auschwitz in Poland. Now 88, she lives at the Sir Moses Montefiore Jewish home in Sydney. She recalls her ordeal down to the last details, sights, sounds and smells. As do all residents at the home, Miss Weiss has a glass cabinet outside her bedroom filled with photographs and ornaments. It's called a memory box, there to preserve memories when the mind can't. The vast majority of Holocaust survivors are now in their 80s and 90s, an age more prone to conditions like dementia and memory loss. Renee Simons is a clinical psychologist whose mother was a former resident at Montefiore.
I began to reflect and look at what was going on in the home when my mother was in the dementia unit. And what I saw was that in the late afternoons especially, there were traumatised residents in the sundowning hours. And I saw that the staff found it quite difficult to deal with a lot of their challenging behaviours that were emerging.
Research shows ageing trauma survivors are more vulnerable to poor mental health than other older Australians. Renee says Holocaust survivors can often relive painful and repressed memories in their later years. She says those memories can be triggered by everyday events. And for those in residential care, those triggers are everywhere.
In the morning, a staff member may arrive at the door and knock on the door, which reminds them of someone coming to wake them early and then offering them a shower. And we know that the shower could remind them of a memory of people and people that they had known and seen being taken to gas chambers.
Renee helped pioneer a training program at the home that identifies these triggers and trains staff members on how to reduce them. As part of the program, every staff member spends a day at the Jewish Museum, then takes part in a training session run by Renee on how to deal with traumatized residents. Renee says since the program began more than 5 years ago, it's helped improve the quality of life at the home. Karen Teshuva is from the Lincoln Centre for Health and Ageing at La Trobe University. She says when people age, they tend to have more time on their hands, and that often means more time for reflection on the past.
They felt that they'd been running in front of the trauma all their adult lives. Physically, as they slowed down, those memories were able to catch up to them.
And for some, like 71-year-old Saram Chan, they're even more disadvantaged. Ms. Chan is a survivor of the Pol Pot regime in Cambodia. Her two young children weren't as lucky, dying of malnutrition. She came to Australia in 2006 with her second husband, but left him after he became abusive. She has no family in Australia and lives in community housing with one other woman who doesn't speak Khmer. Often, says Ms. Chan, they just sit in silence. Almost four decades after the Pol Pot era ended, far from healing all wounds, time has opened them up again. Saram says she thinks of her children every day, and it's taking its toll.
I have mental health issues. I'm on medication and I go to a mental health clinic four times a month. The doctor talks to me about pleasant things to keep my spirits up. He asks me what the matter is and always tries to cheer me up.
For 5 hours each week, Ms. Chan takes part in a Khmer community-run aged care group, the only one in New South Wales. The meeting place is a community hall in Western Sydney. The Cambodian community doesn't have a residential aged care facility. But as the survivors of the Pol Pot era age, health workers say their needs must be better addressed. Jorge Aroche is the CEO of the New South Wales Service for the Treatment and Rehabilitation of Torture and Trauma Survivors. He says more research needs to be done on what he calls a hidden issue.
What we're seeing is really just the top of the iceberg. There's probably a lot more people that are suffering in silence and are experiencing the resurgence of traumatic symptoms.
Jorge Aroche from the New South Wales Service for the Treatment and Rehabilitation of Torture and Trauma Survivors, ending the report from Jeanette Francis.
You are listening to World News Australia on SBS Radio with Claire Atkinson.
A not-for-profit conservation group has started working with traditional landowners in the Kimberley in Western Australia in an effort to protect significant amounts of plant and animal life. Called the Healthy Country Agreement, made between Bush Heritage Australia and the Warrnambool Gumbara traditional owners, it will protect more than 160 plants and animals unique to Australia. The Chief Executive of Bush Heritage Australia, Graham O'Neill, says they also want to protect the Indigenous cultural values on the nearly 1 million hectares of land in the Kimberley. Mr O'Neill told Kate Stoll how the project came about.
The Healthy Country Plan really goes back to the traditional owners of that part of the world, the Warrnambool Gumbara. They, I guess, heard of our work in other parts of Australia and were keen to work with an organisation which was an environment group, but one which was focused on practical outcomes that could help the Warrnambool Gumbara achieve their ambitions and their hopes for their country, which at that time was under claim for native title, and since that time they've been granted native title and they are the recognised and actual traditional owners of that country. So they were looking for an organisation to work with. We had a pretty good track record of working with people to help them achieve their outcomes, and we started on the process of sitting down on country to talk about the development of a plan which would help Aboriginal people achieve their goals. So Bush Heritage had a number of staff who worked with the mob up in the Kimberley, and over a period of time, it took quite a few years to work it through, But we finally arrived at a healthy country plan, which worked foremost to help the Wanamugambra think about law and culture, but also target a number of other key things that they were keen to protect and or manage in what they would say is the right way. So fire is a significant issue, but also look after some of the really special places and plants and animals. And we've got these amazing little kangaroos up there, a monyon or a little rock wallaby type animal, the big antilopine kangaroos.
Under the plan, up to 160 plants and animals found nowhere else on Earth are to be protected. Is that the primary concern? You also mentioned fire management there. There's a range of goals, obviously, that you have in mind.
Yeah, look, that's an amazing number, isn't it? Look, there's a large number of animals as well, which are really special. There's an animal called the golden-back tree rat, for example, which had a much wider distribution across northern Australia and is only now found, as far as we know, in this country. We've got the remarkable plant species that range across that 162 species of plants which are found nowhere else. And you look at that and you recognise that's a really, really important world biodiversity hotspot. It's recognised internationally. A key risk in that space is large, regular, uncontrolled fires that burn a big patch of country and creep into those areas which are the small refuges for the really special plants and animals that live there. And so fire is something that needs more informed local knowledge and the application of that local knowledge to fire management plans. Wanamugambra call it right way fire, which is people being out on country applying fire to achieve not only ecological outcomes but cultural and spiritual outcomes as well, because there's a very strong personal and spiritual dimension to looking after country which is involved in the way fire is applied.
This is a partnership between traditional owners and your group, the private conservation organisation Bush Heritage Australia, which is non-for-profit. Is there a role for government here? Why is this partnership formed this way and not through any sort of public mechanism?
The opportunity, I suppose, to have an organisation like Bush Heritage come in, which we pride ourselves in being pragmatic. We're very practical. We are not involved in, as it were, the political agenda, so we're a neutral organisation which can very quickly sit down and work through practical outcomes for the Wanamugambra in this instance so that they achieve the outcomes they want for their country. So we bring our management expertise, our scientific skills and a very clear sense that it is a partnership that's required here and one which doesn't, as it were, have another agenda. We're working in a space which recognises the partnership value of this arrangement.
The Chief Executive of Bush Heritage Australia, Graham O'Neill, speaking with Kate Stoll. International groups are gathering in Japan to discuss strategies for abolishing nuclear weapons. It follows this month's commemorations of the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki during the Second World War. The head of international law at the Australian Red Cross, Helen Durham, will be addressing the conference. She told Naomi Selvaratnam the international community must look towards the impact of nuclear weapons on future generations.
I will, on behalf of Australian Red Cross and the International Red Cross and Red Crescent movement, talk about a resolution that was passed by the movement last year in November, which urges government to work harder on this topic and requires Red Cross and Red Crescent to raise awareness of the horrific consequences of the use of nuclear weapons.
And what will you be discussing specifically in relation to this resolution? What sort of points do you think will be raised during the discussions?
One of the things I'll be raising is sharing with many of the survivors of Hiroshima who will be attending the event the issues relating to the experiences we've had in this part of the world, for example, the Maralinga testing and also in the Pacific the testing. So I think it's great to remind people of the universality of this issue. In relation to the resolution from the Red Cross, I'll be explaining to the audience at this meeting in Hiroshima where this resolution comes from, that it's based on international law, it's based on things such as the judgment from the International Court of Justice in 1996, it's based very solidly on statements from the United Nations, so it's a very legitimate resolution. But the resolution is exciting because it's the strongest statement to date of the movement about our concerns on the use and existence of nuclear weapons.
And on that point, what sort of lessons do you think have been learned 67 odd years on now from Hiroshima and Nagasaki as well?
One very chilling thing is that the first non-military doctor on the scene of Hiroshima was a Red Cross delegate. And when one gets access to the fax or the telex in those days, in that era, that he sent back to Geneva, it talked about the mysterious impact of this weapon. And today, particularly when we work with groups like these physicians, we have no luxury about being unaware of the horrific consequences of the use of nuclear weapons. Not only on the immediate civilian population, the many thousands that died, but the continual radiation that passes from generation to generation, the impact on the environment, not just immediately, but long term on food security. So we've learnt many, many things since 1945 of the horrors of these weapons, which really have to inform our debate and our discussion on the topic.
And given these lessons about the impacts that can happen so many years on, as you mentioned, I mean, how is it that discussions about whether nuclear weapons should be created still exist today?
For too many years, the whole discussion about nuclear weapons has been located in matters of military doctrine and powers of the state. And what we're doing is trying to urge that any debate about nuclear weapons has to be about the humanitarian consequences. And when you look at those issues, it makes no sense to spend the billions of dollars that the world does today, every year, in maintaining and creating more nuclear weapons. A lot of things such as the discourse or the discussion on deterrence really don't make sense because they're really presented as if they're science, when in reality they're just a philosophy about power and politics and might and weapons. So if we really examine how terrible the impact these weapons have upon future generations of humanity, we really do have to do something further to make sure these weapons are never used again and ultimately do not exist.
Helen Durham from the Australian Red Cross speaking with Naomi Selvaratnam. A new parliament has just been sworn in Somalia in the latest move to try to restore order in the East African country, which has been without a fully functioning government since 1991. Unrest in Somalia in recent years has resulted in thousands fleeing as refugees, some ending up in Australia. Somalia is one of the countries visited by participants in the new series of Go Back to Where You Came From, which airs on SBS television this week. Somalia descended into civil war in 1991 after President Siad Barre was ousted. But Aden Ibrahim had seen it coming long before that. Coming from a family with moderate wealth and education, Mr. Ibrahim was studying a master's degree in Italy in the mid-80s, when international media reports showed him things weren't right at home.
The country was basically in drifting toward civil war, and there was wars on daily basis happening up in the north, in the middle part of Somalia. Government was only running in Mogadishu and not much, and that's why it was just a number of Somalis like me at the time who were a bit sort of educated and leaving the country and just leaving before things collapse.
Aden Ibrahim says he's one of the lucky ones. He escaped the conflict and was able to bring his family over to Australia too. But other Somalis who are not so lucky appear in the series of Go Back to Where You Came From. Some who've made it to Australia but without family members, others who are stuck in limbo in Indonesia, while others remain in poverty in Somalia. Before civil war broke out in the early 90s, Somalia was under the rule of Siad Barre for over two decades. After a failed war with neighbouring Ethiopia in the late 70s, his dictatorship gradually broke down amid anger over years of oppression of his political opponents and ethnic groups. Clan militia eventually overthrew him and forced him to flee the country in 1991. Dr. David Dorwood from La Trobe University says after that, Somalia fell apart.
All this generated thousands of refugees because under Siad Barre, people had moved about, and so It wasn't a situation where clan territories were exclusively homogeneous. They had become very heterogeneous. There were various different peoples there. And now with the Civil War, they began to attack their clan enemies, as they called them. And so it generated thousands of refugees.
From abroad, Aidan Ibrahim watched the unfolding conflict with horror. He'd arrived in Australia in 1986 after applying for refugee status while still a student in Italy, aware civil war was on its way. Safe in Melbourne, on TV, he recognised friends and neighbours in refugee camps, where they'd been filmed by international media crews.
From the BBC, from the Italian channels like Rai Italian, was showing pictures of people streaming into the refugees in Ethiopia, Djibouti and Yemen and Kenya. And I could see, not everyone, but I could see some people I knew, and the people who are came from the same either town and that sort of thing. That was the heartbreak. That was when I felt like, that was the lowest point.
The clans that were fighting for control in Somalia gradually gave way to the control of religious groups, perhaps the best known of them, the Al-Qaeda-linked Al-Shabaab. Its aims are the installation of a strict form of Sharia law in Somalia, and the group says it will wage jihad against those people it considers to be enemies of Islam. The group has stoned women to death for accused adultery and cut off the hands of people it accuses of theft. Al-Shabaab was able to take control of large areas of southern and central Somalia, but it announced a withdrawal from the capital Mogadishu a year ago. Dr. David Dorwood says despite Al-Shabaab's announcement of a withdrawal from Mogadishu, many of those with sympathies to the group are still around. And he says part of the problem is that today's young people have known nothing but war.
It's the disaffected youth who have gravitated to the most extreme. These are young men for whom civil society has never been part of their adult experience. They have no concept of anything but war. I mean, it's been going on now for over 20 years. That means a man must be in his 40s to have reached any kind of adulthood and not known civil war.
Hundreds of thousands of Somalis have died as a result of the ongoing conflict as well as famine and disease. Tony Burns is an Australian who works with the Somali NGO SAID, which means to help in Somalia. He appears in the second episode of Go Back to Where You Came From to show some of the participants the work of SAID, which focuses on helping women, children and the poor. Many international organisations have been restricted by Al-Shabaab in what they can do in Somalia. Local organisations generally manage to avoid the restrictions, but last year SAID was also included in Al-Shabaab's bans. Mr. Burns says Al-Shabaab uses fear and intimidation to restrict aid work and says the group taxes programs and insists on using their own staff. He says aid organisations face challenges in Somalia that they don't in other countries.
If we were to compare it to the Haiti crisis, where I was told that there are more than 1,000 international agencies turned up in the following year, Somalia has very few international agencies operating. Perhaps 20 or 30 at the most, and then they're supported by some hundreds of local agencies, most of which are not particularly sustainable. And most of those agencies have continued through the Shabaab bans and restrictions just by being able to negotiate different kinds of access.
There are thousands of African Union troops in Somalia to fight Al-Shabaab forces. Since Al-Shabaab announced it was withdrawing from Mogadishu, there's been relative calm in the capital. But Somali-Australian Aidan Ibrahim says there's still an Al-Shabaab presence in the city and young men still roam the streets with weapons. He says with law and order still an issue, Somali refugees and their children won't return to help rebuild the country.
You need the guns out of the streets. You need assurance that I can go. People like me can go back. You need law and order. That is the fundamental of any country. If you don't have that,
I'm not going to send my son. My son is now at third year university. He's not going to go to Somalia. If I don't see its safety and his primary safety is assured by the government of the day. So that is what is needed in Somalia.
Somali-Australian Aidan Ibrahim there. And the new series of Go Back to Where You Came From begins tomorrow night on SBS 1 at 8:30pm. Well, to sport now, and a closely fought MotoGP race and the return of Italy's Serie A Football League are among the weekend's sporting highlights. James Nunez reports.
Welcome to World News Australia's Sport Roundup. First to the MotoGP, and Honda's Dani Pedrosa has secured a thrilling win over fellow Spaniard Jorge Lorenzo in the Czech Grand Prix. The pair were neck and neck all the way to the finish line, with Pedrosa just able to sneak out in front. Here's Channel 10's commentary.
Into the final, S left and then right, but Lorenzo fires the bike in front of Pedrosa. Is he going to run it too deep? He's on the inside, but surely it's Pedrosa.
Yamaha's Cal Crutchlow finished third. Pedrosa now sits second on the overall standings, just 13 points behind leader Lorenzo. Australia's defending world champion Casey Stoner was unable to race due to a broken ankle. To football, and star signing Robin van Persie has scored his first goal for Manchester United in the English Premier League in his side's 3-2 victory over Fulham at Old Trafford. Fulham's Irish winger Damien Duff scored first with a penalty in the third minute before van Persie equalised in the 10th minute with a brilliant volley. Here's Fox Sports commentary.
He introduces himself to the Manchester United support with a sumptuous goal.
United went on to win, but their victory was overshadowed by an injury to Wayne Rooney late in the second half. The England striker was stretchered off with a gash in his thigh after he was caught by Fulham's Hugo Rodallega. Rooney is expected to be sidelined for weeks. Meanwhile, European champions Chelsea sits top of the EPL after a 2-0 win against Newcastle United at Stamford Bridge. 21-year-old Belgian attacker Eden Hazard scored his first goal for Chelsea, slotting away a penalty in the 22nd minute. Spanish striker Fernando Torres added a second goal just before half-time, rocketing the ball into the top right-hand corner.
Brilliant goal! Fernando Torres' confidence is back. The kind of instinctive finish we saw so much, particularly in his time at Liverpool.
Chelsea manager Roberto Di Matteo singled out Eden Hazard for praise.
The performance, considering it was our third game in 6 days, so the demand was very high, playing probably against our toughest opposition today. And, Eden Hazard has provided a lot of assists, and it was good for him to get his first goal for us.
In other results, Everton beat Aston Villa 3-1, Tottenham drew 1-1 with West Bromwich, and Norwich and QPR also recorded a 1-1 draw. And Italy's Serie A got underway, with defending champions Juventus securing a 2-0 victory at home against Parma. Steven Lechsteiner gave Juve the lead in the 55th minute before Andrea Pirlo scored with a free kick 3 minutes later. Juventus coach Antonio Conte is serving a 10-month ban for failing to disclose information about match fixing, and Juve is now under caretaker coach Massimo Carrera. Carrera says his side fired up in the second half.
We've started the season well, with a victory in the first match and 3 important points. However, we need to improve because there's a long season ahead of us and those improvements must be quick. At half-time, I told the guys to play as we did during the week in training. I told them to play at a much higher tempo, and they were good. They understood what I asked and completely changed the rhythm of the match in the second half.
Now to rugby. And New Zealand has won the Bledisloe Cup for the 10th consecutive season, trouncing Australia 22-0 in the second test in Auckland. It was the first time in 50 years that the Wallabies had been kept scoreless. All Blacks coach Steve Hansen has told the ABC his side could have won by an even bigger margin.
Well, I think we dominated most parts of the game, and particularly our defence was great. We shut them down, gave them nothing, and we squandered a few opportunities ourselves to score some more points, and it's one of those games where we're probably half a tick away from actually scoring quite a lot.
Wallabies captain Will Genia has told the ABC Australia was outclassed in several aspects of the game.
They were too good, and I think it was a combination of the fact that we were poor as well. You know, we
we weren't good enough getting out of our D zone again. You know, that's 2 weeks in a row. We looked to push the play too much, and to their credit, they pressured us into mistakes. And I think the most disappointing factor was just our first up tackles. You know, we're missing tackles. We weren't going low, we're going high and giving them momentum.
South Africa and Argentina drew 16-all in the other rugby championship match in Mendoza. It's the Pumas' debut in the annual tournament. And in tennis, former Wimbledon champion Petra Kvitova has beaten Maria Kirilenko in straight sets to win the New Haven Open in Connecticut. Kvitova won 7-6, 7-5 to claim her ninth singles title in the US Open warm-up event. And that's the Weekend Sport Roundup for this Monday, but join us again at the same time next week on SBS Radio's World News Australia.
James Nunez there. It's just gone 2 to the hour on SBS. A quick check of the headlines now. The federal Labor government's primary vote has recovered to a six-month high. The Nielsen poll shows Prime Minister Julia Gillard's rating as preferred Prime Minister has risen by 3 percentage points to 46%, overtaking opposition leader Tony Abbott's rating, which fell to 45%. Hundreds of bodies have been found in Syria as government forces launched a deadly assault in the southwestern belt of Damascus. Activists say it's a new bid by government forces to crush once and for all the insurgency in the capital. And now a look at today's weather around the country. In Perth, a shower or two and 20 degrees. Adelaide, partly cloudy and 20. Melbourne, mainly sunny and 17. Hobart, partly cloudy and 16. Canberra, sunny and 16. Wollongong, fine and 18. Sydney, mostly sunny and 16. In Newcastle, a morning shower or two and 18 degrees. Brisbane, a shower or two and 22. Cairns, mostly sunny and 27. And in Darwin, a sunny 34 degrees. That's World News Australia on SBS Radio for now. We'll be back at 5 p.m. World News Australia Radio airs nationally every weekday at 6 a.m. and 5 p.m. on SBS Radio. I'm Claire Atkinson. Thanks for listening.